you know, if Taiwan is to were to fall to China, it's going to, there's no one that is going to be untouched by this. This won't just impact rich countries or democracies. It'll impact everyone. And most people in the world aren't aware of that yet.
Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by Chris Horton, a journalist based in Taiwan since 2015, covering the country's foreign relations, domestic politics, economy, and society. Chris's writing has appeared in The New York Times, Nikkei Asia, Bloomberg News, The Financial Times, and other publications. Chris has just released his first book, Ghost Nation, The Story of Taiwan and Its Struggle for Survival, which we're going to talk about today. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, Cody. Thanks for having me on.
Chris, can you tell me a little bit where you're originally from, please?
Well, I guess the place where I grew up in the States, I'm American, is kind of the Kansas City area, which I'm speaking to you from right now. I actually just gave a couple talks at my alma mater, the University of Kansas, yesterday. So that was a good time. I graduated from the University of Kansas 25 years ago with a Chinese degree, ended up going to China, was there for the economic rise and just, you know, the investment frenzy and just all the amazing stuff that happened during the 2000 to like 2008 period. And then once things kind of leveled off a bit, and earlier in China, like, it felt like every year was better than the year before, and there was just kind of this endless optimism. And then things kind of leveled off a bit after 2008. And by 2013, I kind of felt like I had been in China long enough, and so I moved to Hong Kong, and I thought it would just be lots of boring business stories. But that was right before the umbrella revolution, the umbrella movement of 2014. So I ended up writing. So when I was in China, I was doing lots of kind of business and lifestyle, but also like I was blogging for a living mostly in southwestern China, in Kunming. And when I moved to Hong Kong, I started writing for more mainstream media, and like the New York Times and the Atlantic, and I used those connections after the umbrella revolution was dismantled with no concessions by the Hong Kong government. I kind of knew what was going to happen to Hong Kong. You know, I didn't know the time. I thought it would be 10 years, maybe not 5 years, as it turned out. But I decided to move back to the Mandarin speaking world, and I ended up in Taiwan. I had never lived there, even really traveled there, but it, I just going there for one visit to just to see if I might want to live there. Within an hour of being there, I was sold. And one of the things that really stuck out about Taiwan is how little I knew about it compared to other Asian countries of whatever size. You know, Taiwan is just so invisible. It's a ghost in the international community. You know, to riff off of the book's title.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, the opening paragraph as well of the book, you talk about the hungry ghosts of Taiwan, and how, in a sense, this analogy kind of does play out for Taiwan's role in the world. Because, yeah, what is Taiwan? And if I could share a little personal story of mine. Sure. Back in 2019, I had the privilege to visit a rural part of Hualien. I was filming a project interviewing some local indigenous people, and this landscape of the East Coast really struck me. And then you've got the narrow gauge railways, which are the same as New Zealand, same as Japan, and then these old like diesel engine trains that were hauling freight, and it honestly looked like New Zealand. And then,
oh, wow.
I remember taking photos of this young guy who we were interviewing, and he was wearing a tracksuit. He had this homemade rifle and these monkey skins and these deer skins like stacked behind him in the shed, and we're at the back of his house. And you know, I grew up in a rural part of New Zealand, and I remember thinking this could be a guy that I'm talking to from my hometown, because even though we're thousands of kilometers apart, as I understand it, the Maori people of New Zealand can trace the genetic origins back through to Taiwan many millennia ago. There's this kind
That's
of
correct, yeah.
yeah, this kind of diaspora, this great migration, these chains of migrations that came from Taiwan originally. And then the other story from that episode was I also quite clearly remember interviewing an old, like very old Taiwanese woman who was able to speak Japanese with me. Because you know, I live in Japan, I speak Japanese, and she was telling me about growing up as a little girl and under the Japanese Empire, right, and what that meant to her, and her face sort of lit up as she sort of recalled, you know, these like elementary school Japanese lessons and stuff. And both these encounters struck me as having this profound tapestry of history, of a nation with a story, with a destiny, but of course, all these things and historical fact stand in opposition to the claim that Taiwan is part of the People's Republic of China.
Right.
And I think that would be perhaps somewhere we can start our conversation about your experience with this nuanced Taiwanese identity.
Yeah, well, when I took the plunge and moved, relocated to Taiwan, I thought I had been relatively impervious to communist propaganda about Taiwan, and I realized very quickly that I wasn't, because it's been repeated, you know, in media, not just from China, but like worldwide, you know, to varying degrees for so long. And also the Chinese Nationalist Party, currently an opposition party in Taiwan, but it used to be, prior to the Communist Revolution, it was in control of the Republic of China party state, that was under Chiang Kai-shek, who was basically like, you know, he ruled kind of like an emperor. But yeah, I remember getting to Taiwan, and just nothing quite fit into the, you know, the holes or the spaces that I was expecting it to. You know, I assumed that indigenous Taiwanese would probably be more green, meaning more, you know, voting more for like, the party, the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, which has a primarily Taiwanese identity, versus the Nationalist Party's primarily Chinese identity. And I would expect indigenous Taiwanese to kind of vote more for the Taiwanese identity. But historically, they've voted more blue, more for the KMT or the Nationalists. And, you know, just also the Japan factor. It's really, it's one of those things. Yes, you know, Chinese culture and Chinese history have had an effect and an impact on Taiwan, but so has, you know, so is Japan. Japanese culture, Japanese history, you can feel that in Taiwan as well. And it's so, you know, while it's never been part of the People's Republic of China, there are 4 years that there was a China-based government, like from China, that controlled Taiwan. And during that 4 years, there was like halfway through that 4 years, that was 1945 to 1949. So in 1947, there's a big violent uprising by Taiwanese against them. So that's the only 4 years that you've ever had a Chinese government based in China that controlled Taiwan. So it really, I mean, just starting from there, like it's really hard to justify the People's Republic of China's claim on it today.
Yeah, well, I think there's more nuance to this. I mean, there's a lot more details to these, the nuts and bolts of these claims of sovereignty, which I think maybe is also a good place to start, because I think I understand what you're saying, that there is a propaganda and sort of media shorthands, you know, sort of turns of phrase that are used. And one that struck me from when we met at your talk recently in Japan was this phrase, mainland China, which I had never realized, you know, consciously was actually a piece of propaganda, because by virtue of talking about mainland China, you're referring to also some non-mainland China, aka Hong Kong and Taiwan, being, you know, sort of also in the concept of China, right?
For sure. Yeah, I think in a Hong Kong and China context, mainland is totally fine, because Hong Kong Island is an island, even though Hong Kong, the territory, is mostly peninsular. But for Taiwan, you know, that really is a politically loaded term. You're saying that, you know, whether you realize it or not, you're saying that Taiwan is part of China. Taiwan completes China. And that's just, that's, you know, I mean, it might in the minds of some people, but historically, it's really never been a part of China.
Even within the Hong Kong context, though, like, is that mainland phrase, I mean, I'm not super sure on the Mandarin for it, but like, is it, Is that something that was historically used to refer to like the actual continental, you know, non Hong Kong island China?
It was brought over in the 40s by the KMT, by the Kuomintang, the nationalists, and they, you know, they ended up losing China in 1949 and rebased themselves in Taiwan with their capital in Taipei. And yeah, they, you know, it's really hard for anyone to, you know, if you just look at the facts, you know, no one said mainland before the KMT arrived. Before that, they would call, like, Taiwanese people in Taiwan would call China Tangshan, which is something that I had never heard. And that Tang that's used in the Mandarin term for Chinatowns as well. So I think that might be the etymology. I don't know the etymology, but in Taiwanese and in Mandarin, well, people didn't really speak Mandarin until the arrival of the KMT. So people spoke Taiwanese, which is a Taiwanese variant of a Southern Fujianese language spoken by the original Chinese migrants from 400 years ago, going back as far as 400 years ago. And so, Tangshan was the name that they used. But, you know, international media just totally uses mainland China like it's, like, almost as if it makes them sound smarter, you know, like, we
the mainland.
You know, mainland. And some people just say mainland, and it's just kind of strange.
It's kind of Orwellian, right? You're sort of you're creating these words and these categories. But just zooming out a little bit, man, I'm just conscious we've mentioned a few things: the KMT, Kuomintang, these different phrases. Perhaps just taking a step back and just sketching this kind of picture of sovereignty here, because maybe we could start, just if it's okay, just, maybe just with the Qing Dynasty. You know, not to do a huge history lesson, but there is just a couple of key events here that are probably worth pointing out. And I think maybe starting with Qing and the Japanese imperial period, and maybe you could just paint a bit of a picture of how we arrived at where we're at today and these kind of blow-by-blows over time.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you don't mind, I'll start 401 years ago with the arrival of the Dutch in 1624.
Oh, okay.
They were there for 38 years. It was the Dutch East India Company. They were the world's first stock company, and the Dutch West India Company the same year, 1624. That's when it set up its first established its foothold in Manhattan. So the Dutch were very busy in both the Eastern and Western hemispheres, and they did a lot. They brought introduced a lot of foreign plants and wildlife to Taiwan. But they were a stock company, and so they needed to make money. One of the things they were trying to do was farm, and they didn't want to farm themselves. They were the people running the company. Indigenous Taiwanese had zero interest in being you know, agricultural laborers for these Europeans who had come from so far away. But the Ming Dynasty across the Taiwan Strait was falling apart, and there were tons of poor young Fujianese men, and they were the first wave of Chinese migrants to go over to Taiwan. And it was, you know, in many ways they were abandoning their economic refugees. You know, these were not people who were like, we're going to make Taiwan, you know, part of China. And also it's worth noting here that the first schools in Taiwan were not Chinese. They were Dutch. And the first written language or the written script taught in Taiwan was the Roman alphabet, not the Chinese language. So, you know, but it was the people, it was Koxinga, this half Japanese, half Fujianese son of a pirate who overthrew the Dutch. And with that, he started trying to Sinify Taiwan. So he introduced Confucianism, built Chinese-style temples, schools, and whatnot. So that 21-year period, it was very brief, but he and his son and grandson, they ruled those 21 years, and they started like the real process of Sinification of Taiwan. And then after that, you've got the Qing, and the Qing are Manchus, but they've conquered all of China. And then they decided they weren't that interested in Taiwan until they kind of realized a little bit too late how important it was. But they oversaw two more big waves of immigration from China. and a lot of the areas of Taiwan that had been colonized. It's worth noting that the eastern two-thirds of Taiwan is basically all mountains. And then there's a coastal plain on the west coast where most of the people have lived and where most of the people live today. Maybe 90% of Taiwanese live there. So the Qing ended up basically only, they claimed that they administered all of Taiwan, but their actual rule only included that the non-mountainous coastal plain area, because it was just too dangerous to go up into the mountains. The indigenous Taiwanese were very fierce fighters. They still are today. They're disproportionately represented in like Taiwanese special forces, for instance. So they've always been respected as kind of warriors and whatnot. But the Qing, a Manchu dynasty, claimed all of Taiwan, ruled the western third of it, and I guess 1895, after they lost in their war with Japan, they, in the Treaty of Shimonoseki, they gave Taiwan, all of Taiwan, to Japanese in perpetuity. And then Japan went about, this was Japan's first colony. Imperial Japan was rising. It had plans for the neighborhood, and Taiwan was going to be its showcase colony. So they did, it was obviously, there were extractive goals and, money-making goals and whatnot. But also I think this was kind of propaganda for South China and Southeast Asia, which, Taiwan, due to its location, it was the springboard from which the Japanese would conquer these other parts of the region. But getting back to what Japan did, they brought modern medicine, infrastructure, education, rule of law, lots of industry, raised people's living standards. When the Japanese arrived, most Taiwanese were illiterate farmers. And that changed quite a bit over the 50 years from 1895 to 1945 that the Japanese were there. But they also, they didn't let Taiwanese, really have a say in their own government. And, even though they kind of conquered the coastal plain in 1895 in just like 3 or 4 months, you had a situation where, it took 20 years to conquer the indigenous parts. And there were many bloody wars and just brutal tactics used by the Japanese. And it still took, and this was the Japanese Imperial Army. It took them 20 years to do that. And, what they left, and there was lots of political imprisonment and whatnot. But towards the end, Japan tried to make Taiwanese feel more like they were actually Japanese rather than just Japanese subjects. But it was another kind of case of too little, too late. And by 1945, Japan had surrendered at the end of World War II. And the U.S. had decided that the Republic of China was going to administer Taiwan, at least initially. And the U.S. brought over Chinese soldiers, ROC military, which is now Taiwan's military. They brought them over on boats in 1945. And
Just on that note, though, we've got a parallel history here. So we're talking about Republic of China, but so going back, so 1895 to 1945, we've got this Japanese imperial period. At that same time, though, China is going through some changes, a very different place to it is today. So maybe we come back to China. Looking at the history there, the Qing dynasty obviously collapses, right?
It was overthrown by the Kuomintang, by the people who would later form the Republic of China. And the Kuomintang, right, first and foremost, they were an anti-Manchu movement. And, the Manchus, they made Chinese men grow long braids, like queues, I think they were called. And, cutting off
your
queue.
You see the old photos, right? Like San Francisco gold miners and stuff. They've got the long queues. They had the folded feet for the woman, and
bound feet as well.
So there was these kind of cultural artifacts that you got coming from the Manchus, and again, that was northeast.
So kind of, what you would now call northeastern China, that used to be Manchuria, and also part of the Russian Far East. A large part of the Russian Far East is, I think it's euphemistically referred to as Outer Manchuria now, but it it just all used to be Manchuria. And
then that also got colonized by Japan in the 1930s.
Right? Yes. And then after Japan left, the Republic of China moved in and began a process that was later accelerated by the People's Republic of China. And now, you know, people just refer to Manchuria generally as Dongbei or the Northeast. They don't call it Manzhou. Mm. You know, it's like, and Manchu people have been more or less assimilated into like a Han identity. And I think people look at Tibet and, you know, East Turkestan or Xinjiang, as it's known in China, and, you know, worry about the things that are going on there. But like the level of assimilation that was inflicted on the Manchu people, it's quite interesting. It's very successful, and it's so successful people don't think about it. But that's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got this... This kind of these interesting histories that happen where there's quite a lot of changes happening in China. There's this change happening in Taiwan as Japan comes in, and then really there's this sort of key moment, 1945. We have the defeat of the Japanese Empire in World War II, and then that is a very tumultuous period. So maybe at what point do those two realities start colliding after that?
Well, 1945 was when when Japanese-speaking Taiwanese were told that their new overlords would be the Mandarin-speaking Republic of China, and when it arrived, you know, people didn't speak Mandarin in Taiwan, and they spoke primarily Japanese and Taiwanese, but also Hakka and some indigenous languages. So when the new Republic of China government, which was headed by Chiang Kai-shek in Nanjing, or Nanking as it was known then, but the governor general, Chen Yi, he, like Chiang Kai-shek, they both spoke fluent Japanese. And they could have phased in Mandarin or something like that, but there was no attempt to do that. It was just like, hey, you're Chinese now, and we're going to speak Mandarin. And so instantly, like, all the local Japanese media that people had relied on, it was gone. And you were basically, everyone suddenly had to learn Mandarin. But it was, there were also attempts by Chen Yi. He wanted to conscript young Taiwanese men and send them to China to fight against the communists. And Taiwanese, because a lot of them had been educated as lawyers and knew their rights, you know, they were like, look, we still haven't, we're part of the Japanese Empire, and there hasn't been any sort of formal end of hostilities, and you want to send us over to, you know, the other side of the strait and for a war, you know, but like, we're kind of, you know, we're still technically kind of like enemy combatants in your view, you know. And so I think there was a big concern that basically the young Taiwanese men would be used as cannon fodder in China, and then also they wouldn't be able to help in any sort of insurrection or uprising were it to happen in Taiwan, which it eventually did.
Yeah. So just to clarify here, so we had the surrender of the forces on Taiwan. We had the defeat of the Japanese Empire, but at that point there was no formal handover of sovereignty. There was no declaration that, you know, suddenly Taiwan in international law is now part of China. It was really just the defeat of Japan, right? At that point.
Yeah. So it wasn't until 1951 that the Treaty of San Francisco, you have Japan renouncing its sovereignty over Taiwan. But what's very interesting and a pretty big technical point here is Taiwan, Japan did not say who the, you know, it did not give Taiwan sovereignty or, you know, rule of Taiwan to anyone else. So like it just renounced, there was no recipient country for Taiwan's sovereignty. And so a lot of people in Taiwan and elsewhere will point to that and say, look, you know, Taiwan's sovereignty is, it does not, it's never belonged to the Republic of China. Which was not part of the San Francisco Convention or where the treaty was signed.
Yeah. Well, and this is an interesting time frame as well, because again, to throw some complexity in here, obviously during World War II, the China was governed by the Republic of China,
right,
and they were at war with the Japanese, right? And then post-war, You had the Chinese Civil War, where these communist factions suddenly were able to attack maybe a weakened Republic of China. There was a lot of things going on there. And so this culminated 1949, right? The Chinese Civil War.
That was, yeah, the Civil War pushed in 1950, but yeah. Chiang Kai-shek left at the end of 1949, and a few months earlier in Beijing, Mao Zedong proclaimed the foundation of the People's Republic of China. One thing that's worth noting, and this is where Manchuria comes in again, right before, like a day before Japan surrendered, the Soviets invaded Manchuria, and they took everything they wanted from you know, in terms of like industrial stuff and factories, but they allowed the this wasn't Russia, this was the Soviets, and they were very close to the Chinese Communist Party, and they basically let the communists move in, and they let them have all of Japan's weapons and their equipment, military equipment, military stockpiles, and that really gave them a major toehold, a foothold in China, northern China, and then they were able to push down southward, and that was it was very much the ROC was weakened. The ROC military was definitely weakened after 8 years of war with Japan, but that assistance, that last minute assistance from the Soviet Union at the end of World War II, really boosted the chances of the communist revolution's success. There could have been a situation where, you know, it would have been much more difficult. Maybe, you know, the communist part of China would only be a few provinces. And I believe even Mao Zedong kind of had that in mind initially, but their luck just kept getting better and better. And yeah, eventually the Republic of China it exiled itself. It became a refugee government in Taiwan. And for a lot of Taiwanese people, for people who had whose families predate the arrival of the KMT in the 40s, they're viewed very much as a colonial, you know, the ROC is a Chinese colonial government, and the KMT is a, I mean, they still call themselves the Zhongguo Guomindang in Mandarin, Chinese Nationalist Party. You know, the ROC has become Taiwanized, Taiwanified, you know, over the past several decades, but the KMT still remains at its core a Chinese party.
So this concept then of a rump state, this period of time where we've got the Republic of China in Taiwan at the same time claiming to be the government of you know, quote unquote, mainland China. Maybe you can explain that concept of a rump state in this context.
I think one of the most unique things about the rump state and Chiang's claim to be the rightful ruler of China is the United Nations. So it wasn't until 1971 that the Republic of China lost the China seat on the Security Council at the UN. So the Republic of China, it was the first country attacked in the Second World War, and so it was given the honor of being the first signatory in 1945 to the UN Charter. And the ROC was also during World War II, the ROC was an ally of the U.S. But after the success of Mao's revolution, I believe Eisenhower was it Eisenhower or Truman? I think it was Truman. Anyways, the U.S. basically was like, you know, we're done with them, you know. And then after North Korea invaded South Korea in 1950, that changed everything. It was like, okay, communism wants to expand. And then suddenly the survival of the Republic of China, which was vehemently anti-communist, that was of utmost importance to Washington. And so then the ROC and Chiang Kai-shek's rule had to be protected at all costs. And yeah, you look at you talk about like the transformation of value, and that was, you know, like for the U.S. And other countries, other industrialized, developed countries, democracies, you know, in the past, Taiwan's value was as an anti-communist bulwark and kind of the front line of you know, kind of containing communist expansion. But now today, it's more as a democratic partner and a technology supplier. You know, it's Taiwan's always been important, at least, you know, since the post-war era, but its importance today, its value today has really shifted in from what it was back then.
Yeah. Well, I want to get into that as well, Chris, but just one quote here from your book, which I think in a sense summarizes what we've just talked about at this kind of, this is a winding history, but the absence of a legal foundation for Beijing's claim has led to the CCP to stress the narrative of Taiwan as an inalienable part of China since ancient times.
Right.
And as we've just discussed, I mean, that's simply not true. And there's this kind of war of words, this propaganda that's deployed to make it out as if it's a historical truth, when in fact it's historical fiction. And I think this is very interesting because it is telling that from a legal perspective, international law, I mean, you can trace the story quite clearly. And by virtue, because you actually interviewed, I believe, former President Li Teng-hui,
yes,
who he said to you, I never advocated Taiwan independence because Taiwan is essentially already independent,
right?
Which is, I think, fascinating.
Well, the last two presidents, the current president Lai Ching-te and the previous his predecessor Tsai Ing-wen, they both have kind of declared independence, but retroactively. They said, there's no need for us to declare independence. How can we, you know, how can we say that we're not part of China if we've never been? How can we leave a People's Republic of China that we've never been a part of? You know, and it's like divorcing someone you've never married. You just can't do it. You know, at least not logically. But it's you know, I think what the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party have really benefited from was all the propaganda about Taiwan being Chinese that the Kuomintang and the ROC did before all this stuff that we've been hearing from Beijing. And it was, you know, it is the ROC. It was Chiang Kai-shek who first decided that in 1943 he wanted to take control of Taiwan. And it was a month or two later that the Chinese Communist Party was like, we think Taiwan is part of China too. So both parties' claims, you know, even though they said it's always been China, they never cared about Taiwan until 1943. And that was after Japan, it became apparent that Japan was not going to win the war. And so then it's like, oh, you know, Taiwan's up for grabs. And you know, yeah, it used to be part of the Qing dynasty, but so did Arunachal Pradesh in India, which the PRC and CCP claim, but also that massive chunk of outer Manchuria that is now Russia. And, you know, it's worth noting that the Qing dynasty, which followed the Ming, the Qing was a Manchu dynasty that conquered Ming China and added a lot onto that, parts of Mongolia, Tibet, and East Turkestan. And so, like, this claim by Chinese nationalists on either side of the strait that the Qing borders are historically Chinese borders, it's a bit of a stretch. And also a lot of those frontier areas that were ruled by the Qing were ruled very loosely, just like Taiwan was, which was most of the administration work that was done in Taiwan for the Qing was done by like local Taiwanese gentry.
Yeah. Well, something, and again, Kuomintang, abbreviated KMT, so we can CCP, Communist Party of China, Chinese Communist Party, and KMT, Kuomintang. It's interesting because even though these two parties were mortal enemies during the Chinese Civil War, we're in this fascinating position where they are both Han Chinese ethno-nationalist parties with Leninist roots, as you say, in your book. And they're kind of buddies as well because they hang out with each other now and they go and talk and they kind of support each other. And so it's like this horseshoe, you know, they've gone all the way around and they actually have, you know, relations and they talk. And so there's this kind of interesting turn of politics, right? And
horseshoe, I would say a triangle. And one part of one side of the triangle ended up collapsing. So you had this like kind of equilibrium where, let's color code it here. The Greens are the Taiwanese people who identify as Taiwanese. The Blues are the Chinese identifying people in Taiwan affiliated with the KMT or the Kuomintang. And then the reds are the Chinese Communist Party in China. So the reds and the blues were against the greens wanting to have independence for Taiwan, a Taiwanese state. The greens and the blues opposed any, you know, attempt by China to invade Taiwan. The reds and the greens, they were both quite anti-KMT. But at one point in 2005, after the first DPP president, Chen Shui-bian, was reelected, that was when Taiwan democratized in the 1990s. The first presidential election was 96. And then that was Lee Donghui, who was very much he was Taiwanese born and very much had a Taiwanese identity, despite being a member of the KMT. And chairman of the KMT when he was elected.
And this is the guy you interviewed, right, who talked about Taiwan.
Right, one of the two presidents that I've interviewed, for the book. But I've interviewed him shortly before his death in 2018, I believe it was. But he oversaw the democratization of Taiwan, and I asked him what he was most proud of in his political career, and I assumed that would be it. But he said nationalizing the military was his greatest achievement, because the military, the ROC military, had been the armed wing of the KMT, and he changed it so that it was nationalized, and it was its loyalty was to the country, the Republic of China Constitution, not to one political party. And that's what you have in China today. You know, there is no Chinese military and there is no Taiwanese military. The Chinese military, when we talk about it, that's the armed wing of the CCP. They swear allegiance to protect the power of the CCP. They do not swear allegiance to the people of China or the Chinese Constitution. And then in Taiwan, there is no Taiwanese military because it's the ROC military. So it just highlights how complex things are in the story of Taiwan and its relations with China and also, you know, with two Chinas, with the Republic of China and the PRC. But in 2005, you basically had the KMT and the CCP being like, okay, this Taiwanese identity thing is becoming a problem. That, you know, it's the genie is out of the bottle. We need to get past our little differences over the past and you know, we both see eye to eye, and they both really look down on Taiwanese identity and Taiwanese culture. They think of it as inferior to Chinese-ness, and they've got more in common as Chinese ethno-nationalists, Han ethno-nationalists, than they have not in common. They really have and they're meeting more frequently. The current KMT. Caucus whip for the legislature, Fu Quanqi. He led a 17 legislator delegation to Beijing, where they met with Xi Jinping's right hand man on Taiwan policy, Wang Huning, in the Great Hall of the People. And you know, they had these discussions behind closed doors. And when they returned to Taipei, they had a very new agenda that coincidentally really aligned with all of Beijing's goals in Taiwan. So, like, you know, trying to get rid of Taiwanese history from textbooks, from which was only recently introduced to textbooks in Taiwan. Everybody had to study Chinese history before, and so it's it. There's very much a sense that the Communist Party, through the KMT, through this closer relationship with the KMT, the Communist Party kind of has a toehold in Taiwan's legislature right now, and that has a lot of people feeling very uneasy.
Yeah. Well, just on that note as well, it's interesting, again, the People's Republic of China and the Communist movement there was supposed to end dynasties and feudalism in China. In a sense, the nationalist movement as well, the KMT and the CCP, both have that origin story of overthrowing empires and dynasties. Yet here we are today with the Emperor Xi Jinping, and prior to that, the Emperor Chiang Kai-shek, out of Taiwan, and these kind of, I don't know what to make of that, man.
Mao was an emperor too, you know. I mean, I don't feel like it's too too wild to to refer to at least martial law Taiwan, you know, under Chiang Kai-shek. You know, that's the Chiang dynasty, which I think I refer to it as such in my book. But also, yeah, you know, this is the communist dynasty in China. You know, it feels very similar to a dynasty. And I think that's for people like Xi Jinping and Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek, they do kind of, I feel like the way they act and the way they speak or spoke, it all very much feels like kind of like an emperor's outlook rather than a modern politician's.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting, that this kind of emphasis on the blood nationality of Han Chinese, yeah. is something that we can look at Mein Kampf. You know, people of the same blood should be in the same Reich, which is obviously, yeah, Adolf Hitler, and this idea of a national identity through blood. And yeah, I think this is a very interesting aspect, because I believe it was Frank Dakota who talked about how, you know, China is this huge country, yet officially it has one time zone. It's this unity, this kind of oneness that encapsulates everything, and anything outside of that necessarily needs to just get absorbed in and become the one. And so, yeah, the idea that you've got Taiwanese identity or Tibetan identity or Muslim identity outside on the fringes, that isn't really compatible. It needs to be Chinified, Sinified. And I don't know, it's kind of a confronting idea, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if you look at language policy in China, in the PRC, you know, like the way that local languages and ethnic languages have been de-emphasized and kind of subsumed by Mandarin, which in China they call Putonghua, and like, you know, in Hong Kong even, you know, the amount of Cantonese that's being spoken because a lot of Hong Kongers have left and they've been replaced by Chinese, by their mainland countrymen. But it's you know, the disappearance of Chinese languages, you know, and the strengthening of Mandarin has been a massive trend for decades now. And it's getting to the point where, you know, like my Chinese friends, if they're from Shanghai or Yunnan, they can speak Shanghainese or Yunnanese, but the Shanghainese or Yunnanese that their parents or grandparents speak, you know, there's a big difference because Mandarin's just creeping into everything, and people are losing expressions and losing words and ways of describing things. And so it's there is this kind of unity, and, you know, in mind, and unity does sound good, but if it's if it's imposed kind of like steamroller style, I don't know if that's ideal.
So I want to bring us to today, because you alluded to the high tech manufacturing that's taking place in Taiwan. And I mean, I've seen this with my own eyes, you know, taking the bus from Taipei down to Taichung and passing through that huge industrial belt, and you just see these big warehouses and these manufacturing facilities, you know, CPUs, graphics processing units, all of these you know, silicon wafers, all this technology. And in a sense, in the media, I get an impression, Chris, that this is kind of pointed at, okay, you know, Taiwan, TSMC, you know, the CPU fabs are this thing, but we've just spent, you know, 40 minutes talking about this history, and this interesting nuanced history that's arrived at where we are today. Yet now we're also adding to that the absolute vital importance of Taiwan for semiconductors, right? And
right.
I mean, that's its own interesting history, but the reality of it today, maybe you can speak to kind of what that means, like, geopolitically.
Sure. Well, TSMC is a Taiwanese company that produces basically all of the world's most advanced semiconductors. And I think like maybe 60%, or maybe Taiwan produces 60%, I can't remember. But Taiwan really punches above its weight, and TSMC is kind of god tier in terms of, you know, tech manufacturers. And so people didn't really get this until 2020, 2021, when there was the pandemic kind of caused a semiconductor crunch or shortage. There were a lot of the demand for semiconductors, advanced semiconductors, moved away from cars and some other items. And shifted towards laptops, mobile devices, tablets, and stuff like that because people were working at home and you know, isolating themselves from others. So you know, then the car, the automotive production lines came back online a little bit earlier than they were expecting to, and they're like, "Hey, TSMC, remember that order we canceled? Can we get that now?" And they're like, We don't really have any spare capacity, guy, you know, and so suddenly you've got this situation where all around the world, you know, whether it's car manufacturers, you know, big multinational companies producing whatever, you know, electronics, and then also just governments in general being like, I mean, it was seriously like a oh shit moment, you know, where people are like, how did we not know that we were this reliant on Taiwan and also just one company in Taiwan? And that was really, I think, a wake-up call for a lot of countries. And while Taiwan was already getting lots of kind of, you know, thoughts and prayers type stuff from people, you know, like, you know, and there was this, you know, there's this like China shouldn't bully Taiwan talk, you know, but not really anything. There wasn't much action behind it. But then suddenly, and people weren't really going to Taiwan, high-level people weren't going to Taiwan to visit that much. And then once everybody realized that Taiwan was super important and that everyone else had just realized that just like they had, you know, it was like, oh, and suddenly Tsai Ing-wen, who was president at the time, she's just getting delegation after delegation. Everybody is aware now. Everyone is aware that Taiwan produces chips, and these are important chips. And so now, even though it's not in the UN and it's not recognized by the ROC government in Taiwan, isn't recognized by most countries, Taiwan does have a seat at the table. So it's like, so, you know, since 401 years ago when the Dutch first arrived, it wasn't until probably 2016 that you really had a situation where, like, the government of Taiwan really felt like a government of Taiwanese people rather than outsiders, rather than like, you know, the ROC governor general or the Japanese governor general or the Qing. You know, for almost all of its existence, Taiwan has been, you know, it's been ruled or its fate has been decided by outsiders. And you're kind of 4 centuries in now, you're finally getting to a point where Taiwan really has like, it's got a seat at the table, and it has more agency and more leverage than it ever has. And so you know, and now you've got two different kinds of value propositions for Taiwan. You know, like, if you care about human rights, the human rights of 23.5 million Taiwanese people, if you care about regional stability and democracy and freedom of expression and stuff like that, then Taiwan's great. You know, you're going to like a lot of things about Taiwan. It's not perfect. It has issues like any country, but, you know, then, so let's say you don't care about human rights and you don't care about the Taiwanese people, but you do care about your portfolio. You know, if Taiwan were to be attacked by China, Bloomberg News, not known for being, you know, wildly speculative, they estimated a few years ago that a Chinese invasion attempt would shave 10% off of global GDP. And so, you know, that chip shortage that we had during COVID, it would be way worse than that. And when the smoke settled, you know, when the dust settles, you know, maybe China's going to be in the position. If TSMC's gone, China will suddenly be one of the biggest producers of what will then be the most advanced chips in the world, and then that just gives China even more leverage. So, you know, if Taiwan were to fall to China, there's no one that is going to be untouched by this. This won't just impact rich countries or democracies. It'll impact everyone, and most people in the world aren't aware of that yet. And I think, you know, Taiwan, you know, it can't really, I think it's in a tough position to deter China on its own, and it's moving in that direction as the harassment from China is increasing, and you know, like, signals from Washington are less reassuring maybe than they had been in the past. But they're working more with the Philippines and Japan, and the Philippines and Japan are working more with them, because if Taiwan were to become part of the PRC, then suddenly the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese military, the CCP's military, is suddenly on the doorstep of both Japan and the Philippines. And that's a much tougher situation for both Manila and Tokyo than what they're facing now.
Yeah, just taking a step back, again, in the kind of current media moment, you know, invasion of Taiwan, you know, you're going to see these like headlines or whatever, but actually, like, let's take a step back. I mean, these two countries have been kind of back and forth, and there's been, since the end of World War II, there's this kind of nuanced relationship. But why now? Why now is talk of amphibious invasion? You see the photos of these ships that the Chinese are manufacturing to do amphibious invasion. Like, why is that now suddenly on the books after 50, 60 years of this back and forth?
Yeah, I think it's more than 7 decades of Beijing threatening to invade.
Sorry, yeah.
First of all, like, China has only recently acquired something close to the arsenal and, you know, the things that they would need to do to successfully, you know, attempt the largest amphibious invasion in human history. I mean, this would be way bigger than D-Day, way bigger than Normandy, and the distance that they have to cross is 3 times the width of the English Channel. The waters are much choppier. The beaches are much smaller in Taiwan than around Omaha Beach and Normandy and all that. So it's really, there was a joke for a long time, you know, like, they called the Chinese threat to invade, you know, they referred to it as, it would be the million man swim, you know, because they didn't have a navy, you know, like, historically the Chinese military and even the ROC military has been more of an army, more of a land-based army. But it was after Lee Teng-hui was elected president in 1996, when China was firing missiles into waters off of the northern and southern coasts of Taiwan to show its displeasure with Taiwan's first democratic presidential election. It was during that time that Bill Clinton sent two carrier groups from the 7th Fleet in Japan to the northern and southern tips of Taiwan, and China realized it had nothing that it could do to dislodge them from there, and it stopped its hostilities towards Taiwan, or its aggressive actions. But it was that moment, I think, in 1996 when the CCP realized it needed a modern navy. And it's so you've had, since the late 90s, you've had the biggest military buildup in human history during peacetime. That's what the PLA has gone through. But the Navy and also its rocket force, those are the two areas that have really kind of become much more important to the mix with regard, you know, compared to like the land army.
Yeah. Well, just if I can just pull on that thread, Chris, because I guess I'm looking at this with sort of two lenses, right? One lens is, there's political posturing, there's the black box of Chinese communists and the kind of the posturing and, you know, the image making as one piece. And then the other is that they are just slowly but surely they're rebuilding, they're rearming, and they're just going to go and do what they want to do, and they're just waiting for the right time. And in a sense, I think both of those are kind of interlaced with like propaganda and posturing and saber rattling.
Psychological warfare as well, for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, how do you break those down? Because in a sense, I mean, it's pretty clear that an invasion of Taiwan would be this incredible undertaking that disrupts the entire global economy. I mean, as you say, 10% of the global GDP. But I mean, it's not a country like Russia, Ukraine, where you can just walk over the border. I mean, it would be, if it is a low-intensity invasion, low-intensity ongoing pacification, I mean, that's got to go across all of that water. There's just so much there that would the Chinese communists risk the entire fragility of their own country by undertaking something like that? Or have they kind of committed to it in a narrative sense? Like, they've talked about it for so long that they have to act upon it to kind of show that they still have the goods, you know, and I don't know how to unpick all of that, sorry, but maybe
I think it's best to just start from the top. The most important thing for the Chinese Communist Party is to retain control of China, to stay in power, and that is the main goal of the People's Liberation Army is to make sure that happens. I mean, the last time that the PLA fought and won a war was 1989 when it invaded Beijing. And, it's like suddenly going from that to we're going to do the most difficult type of war possible with very little warm-up beforehand. I mean, I think a lot of the aggressive behavior towards Japan and the Philippines and Taiwan, it's all to get some more experience. I mean, the U.S. military, it's always fighting something somewhere. It's always engaged somewhere. But the Chinese military, not so much. And I mean, the Taiwanese military, at least it hasn't fought in anything. For the ROC military in Taiwan, hasn't fought since it lost China. But it did. They at least keep busy with disaster relief and things like that, and they're also modernizing too. It's during the previous couple decades, the ROC was not taking the threat from China terribly seriously, the ROC military. And while it was still answering to the government in Taipei, up until very recently, I think the ROC military kind of, it was its own political entity, and it called its shots a bit more than a military in a fully democratized country might. But then on the other hand, this is a really difficult thing, and China's military is untested and all that. But then you also have a lot of people just didn't think Putin would invade Ukraine, and then he did. So if a lot of people think Xi Jinping won't invade Taiwan, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much that's worth. I think if they're threatening, military invasion, which they definitely are, and these joint exercises that surround and encircle Taiwan, I think those threats should be taken at face value, and they should be a response based on that being like a legitimate threat makes sense. You need to prepare. Go ahead.
So pulling on that thread though, because I guess the Chinese Communists' primary objective is to maintain the control of power. And this is just basic Marxist-Leninism. As Mao Zedong said, all power comes from the barrel of a gun. They will gun down people like they did in Chinamen to maintain that power. Yet I just wonder what your gauge is on how important these promises and these narratives are towards taking over Taiwan. Like, is the balance of power here that, like, could this be a perpetual thing, similar to maybe what we see with North and South Korea, where there's this long-term kind of angst, yet it kind of has arrived at a impasse, and it's just sort of, in stasis, whereas are we not heading towards maybe a place where Xi Jinping has made these proclamations? There's kind of like a time frame, there's dates that have been set in stone that if they're not achieved, it kind of undermines the legitimacy of the CCP.
I don't think Xi Jinping has established any clear goals other than in the next couple of years, the military needs to be ready to invade. There's no deadline for invasion. And I think, I'm sure there are people in Beijing who are looking at ways, non-military ways, in which to acquire Taiwan. And I think the Kuomintang is the main vector through which they could potentially do that. So if the Kuomintang were to retake the presidency in 2028 and maybe also have control of the legislature, then suddenly you're probably going to see top Chinese officials visiting Taipei and closed door negotiations and things like that. But you also might see, as in 2014 and many other years in recent decades, big protests by Taiwanese people against getting closer to China. So it's really hard to say how things are going to play out because the KMT, the Kuomintang, they just voted for a new leader, Zheng Liwen. She's the new chair of the KMT, their second female chair ever. And she's, you know, she's pro-unification. She's not hiding it or anything. And so it'll be interesting between now and 2028, when the next presidential election is, if she really pushes this pro-China thing and people don't like it, that could really spell disaster for the KMT at the ballot box, which if they were to lose this coalition that they've got running the legislature right now, and then also not regain the presidential office, they're kind of out in the wilderness. And then, you know, that might cause Xi Jinping and others in Beijing to kind of be concerned and be like, you know, is the KMT ever going to come back to power? That might set, you know, kind of set off a new sense of urgency. So there's a lot of things going on. You know, Xi Jinping has an economy that is it seems to be giving him some trouble right now. And then there's the trade war. And I don't know. I think the general mood in China isn't terribly positive. But, you know, that might be, in his mind, the right time to try to make a move on Taiwan and try to unite the country, and also maybe catch the United States in a moment of weakness.
Yeah, well, this is interesting. If I can, again, a bit of speculation here, but a pro-unification KMT taking the presidency, and are you implying Zheng Liwen would be the president if she is the chairman of the KMT?
Zheng Liwen, she has the ability to appoint the nominee for the presidency. Okay. So presumably it would be someone ideologically aligned with her. And I think, you know, the way that the KMT has been drifting closer and closer to the CCP, you know, it's not hard to imagine a very pro-China candidate. But like, how would they fare? That's really hard to say.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because in a sense, you know, the kind of specter of military invasion, you know, is kind of background noise. You know, is this mutually assured destruction, in a sense. You know, it would mess a lot of things up. I don't think there's a clean way to navigate that economically or militarily. And so the kind of the option then they're presented is the political pathway. You know, if KMT gets in, they start maybe trying to create these pathways for unification potentially. But that would imply that KMT has a mandate from the people if they're getting elected in and they're being voted in. Right. And so that would imply that there is sort of within Taiwan, maybe there's this conflicted identity of like, well, what do we actually want to do? I mean, I don't know what the numbers are like, but I mean, there must be a large number of people who are supporting.
So I guess like a very simple way to describe voters in Taiwan is you've got 25% who are hardcore KMT, 25% who are hardcore DPP, and 50% who are basically swing voters. But they don't tend to swing very much when it comes to the presidential election. So the DPP candidates have won the last three. The Taiwanese identifying candidates have won the last three elections, right? And the KMT hasn't come close. And then you've got the situation where, like, legislators, they don't really affect like kind of foreign policy for Taiwan that much. And so they're a little bit less risky. Yeah, maybe you want to, you know, people give legislators they just worry about what they might do with regard to China less, and also mayors and other local politicians. But you know, if you look at the trends, the polls by National Zhengzhi University, which was founded in China, it was the former party school of the KMT. So this is not like a green or a DPP institution by any means. And their polls time and time again show that only like 3% of people in Taiwan want unification with China now. And there's varying degrees. There are some people who are like never, or, you know, like declare a Taiwanese state today. Another one is like, keep the status quo and unify later, keep the status quo and declare independence later, or keep the status quo and just keep doing it until something, a good option becomes clear, you know? But the thing is, there's no doubt that most Taiwanese people, whether they're green or blue, would prefer to just keep things as they are, the status quo. You know, Taiwan has a government called the Republic of China, and it is sovereign and independent of any other country's rule. And so, you know, also the sense of identity, there's a very small percentage of Taiwanese people who who think of themselves exclusively as Chinese. Everybody, even people who are like, you know, proud of their, you know, their family's Chinese heritage and ancestry, they're like, well, but I'm Taiwanese, you know. And so it's
yeah.
Not, there's nobody. This would, you know, for the KMT to move towards some sort of unification plan, it would be a disaster for the KMT, because you would get like what happened in 2014 when, you know, tens of thousands of students took to the streets in Taipei and occupied the legislature and the Sunflower Movement. But the thing is, you know, like there are concerns that you know, if we're going to go full speculation, you know, like if the KMT were to do something like this and there were big protests, you know, would it be possible for them to call in for help from the PLA, you know? And then that's where you start entering into really, you know, hard to predict or, you know, kind of, you know, figure out kind of scenarios. But, you know, it's the more that the KMT and CCP coordinate in China, the more that you need to, I think, you know, kind of consider these possibilities.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting as well. Just, I mean, a final note there. I mean, the experience of Hong Kong is certainly very closely followed. And, you know, I was just in Hong Kong recently, and I mean, it ain't what it used to be, you know, and
I think that's
pretty clear. Yeah, it's pretty clear to a lot of people. And it's probably important to underscore this whole conversation, but Taiwan is the freest democracy in Asia, you know, yeah. In terms of a lot of the rankings.
It's got the freest media environment, the first country to have same-sex marriage in Asia, the first to apologize to its indigenous peoples. Yeah, it's a very progressive place. It's got great chips, you know, if you're into tech and business, but like if you're into democracy and human rights, it's got a lot going on there too, yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, because I mean, the other piece of speculation right now, there's 12 countries that recognize Republic of China, formal diplomatic ties, plus the Vatican, I think.
Yes.
I don't know if the Vatican counts as a country, but so you've got a number of countries. Dwindling though year after year, and a lot of these are kind of small countries recognizing Republic of China. The question we must ask, what happens when that number goes to zero? Because this isn't a fantasy. I mean, this is a real place with, you know, billions of dollars of high-tech stuff being produced and exported, it's a
near G20 economy.
Yeah, like it's in the top 20 and almost in the top 20, yet what happens when it's no longer recognized by anyone? You know, this isn't just like I was saying to a friend, this isn't an oil rig that someone suddenly putting a flag on saying, hey, I'm a country. This is a country that no one knows what to do when it doesn't become a country. And it could actually be that this is sort of maybe the impasse that we're heading to, where de facto it is just Taiwan. And, you know, the Republic of China almost just evaporates off. And yeah. That would be an interesting situation.
I do wonder if China even wants to test those waters, because, like, as a top Taiwanese diplomat once said to me, you know, he's like, well, you know, what if China takes all of our, you know, so-called diplomatic allies? You know, does the Republic of China just end and we just become Taiwan, you know? So I think kind of creating a situation like that where no one recognizes an ROC government in Taiwan, making Taiwan even more of a de facto country, perhaps, in some people's eyes, maybe they don't want to do that. And also, you know, for a long time they had an unlimited number of countries that they could peel away from the ROC, and now they're down to 12 in the Vatican. And like, you know, and also most people in Taiwan don't really care. I mean, you know, I think they appreciate being their government being recognized by Paraguay and you know, small countries in the Caribbean and Eswatini and the, you know, the Vatican. But also, I mean, I think that, you know, they know that the most important relationships are with their unofficial friends, their unofficial partners, the U.S., Japan, Australia, you know, other countries, the Philippines now much more so than before. And also, you know, countries in Eastern and Central Europe are really warming up to Taiwan, because they're kind of in a similar situation and they're trying to exchange best practices. So, you know, like the anti-drone nets that are being used in Ukraine are now starting to be installed in kind of near critical infrastructure in Taiwan. And, you know, that these exchanges are helping both sides. And Taiwan's trying to develop its own like drone supply chain. And, you know, this right now it's not much, but it could be something later. But yeah, it's an interesting time, and like everything's kind of in flux for sure.
It's always in flux. Well, look, man, thank you so much. It's a fascinating, fascinating journey. And I do recommend Ghost Nation, the story of Taiwan and its struggle for survival. This is Chris's new book, first book, incredible story, history of Taiwan up to the present day. And I mean, you still have your home there, though. So, I mean, I guess my final question to you, Chris, I mean, you must have some thoughts towards the future. I mean, how do you feel personally about the future, your life in Taiwan, and sort of what the future holds for you there?
Well, I'm not planning on leaving anytime soon. I do have a life there. I've been there for 10 years. And so, yeah, Taiwan feels like home. And, you know, in terms of the future, like I would say the future everywhere is a lot shakier than it used to be. And so, like, yeah, well, Taiwan has this this threat looming from China, you know, as we noted, you know, Xi Jinping has his plate quite full. And, you know, it's really hard to say what might transpire in the next 2 or 3 years. But I think by like 2027, 2028, I think after the next Taiwanese election, in January 2028, I think it'll be a lot clearer, like kind of what direction Taiwan is headed, where it's like, it's struggling to deal with the challenge from China and to, you know, basically prepare for a possible war, but also prepare its friends to, you know, work with it to deter that war from even happening, you know. If there's a possibility that could happen, or then you know there's also a possibility that there's some sort of at least unforeseeable right now outcome where the KMT wins the election and suddenly rapprochement with Beijing is on the menu. And, you know, it's really hard to say. I think the next 2 or 3 years will really kind of shape how that election turns out. But I don't see China changing its playbook too much. I think the constant military threats and trying to undermine the central government through cooperation with the KMT, but also with KMT like legislators and mayors and whatnot, I think that'll continue to happen as they keep building more and more hardware. You know, I mean, their third aircraft carrier is soon to be commissioned, and it's technologically far superior to their first two. And they're building the first drone carrier. They've got robot dogs, all sorts of stuff that will be even more lethal and terrifying probably in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, they can build all the weapons and all the drones, but I often think back to Japan. You had a stock market crash in 1989, but you had a democracy and you had a population that understood freedom and understood what was going on. And I sometimes wonder, is it a case that Taiwan just needs to keep being Taiwan, being chilled? You know, I kind of think of it as the beanbag country, because it's a chill place, man. Taipei, man, is so chill. No one's stressed out. It's easygoing, good food. And it's kind of like, it just needs to go through this. And, you know, China builds all this stuff up. It makes it all happen. But as you say, it's got its own economic worries. And the problem with communism is that when the shit hits the fan, you know, you're going to go for the guy at the top, and it becomes very violent. And I do kind of have a hope in my, I mean, this is kind of my vibe from my time in Taiwan. It just needs to kind of keep going and just kind of muddle through this. And the Chinese will do what they do. And in a sense, the collapse of the Xi Jinping empire seems to me a little bit more kind of pertinent or kind of important in this conversation. And hopefully Taiwan can just sort of step around the outside of that, right, potentially.
Yeah, well, I think that's what Taiwan is historically known for is navigating tight political and diplomatic and geostrategic spaces. But you know, there's no guarantee that whoever comes after Xi Jinping will be better for Taiwan than Xi Jinping.
Good point.
There's a lot of people that are like, you know, we just need to outlast Xi Jinping. But I'm like, you know,
it could be worse. Yeah,
it can always be worse. But yeah, I think another thing I just in the news today I saw that military recruitment has gone up considerably. Partially, I think, because for privates, for foot soldiers, like I think the wages have been increased dramatically, maybe even close to double.
And in Taiwan.
So a lot of people have, you know, there's been this long running thing that, oh, the Taiwanese won't fight. But I think there's a lot of different things going on in Taiwan these days that are showing that Taiwanese do care about what they have, and they fought to get what they have. So why would they not fight to keep it?
Yeah, and I mean, one more thing on that. I did hear a commentator talk about how it's highly unlikely that Chinese parents are going to want to send their single child to go fight in some war, an aggressionary war, versus, you know, people defending their home are going to fight regardless. But, you know, there is this kind of the role of the one-child policy and single-child families, you know, people being pretty precious. I mean, drones maybe change that a little bit, but still, unless you've got foot soldiers on the ground, you're never going to take a place. So I don't know, man. I hope peace and love prevails in a kind of typical fashion. But Chris Horton, thank you so much for your time, sharing your incredible writing. And yeah, I hope we can keep in touch, and maybe either when you're in Japan next, maybe when I'm in Taiwan next, go down to the night markets, get some good food, and talk
Sounds
a bit
great.
More.
Yeah. Thanks again for having me on.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.